Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jonathan Maines of the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why his group is challenging President Obama's order to assassinate a U.S. citizen who is a suspected terrorist without following minimum standards of due process. Ken Heckler, candidate to replace West Virginia's late U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd, who discusses his number one campaign issue, ending mountaintop removal coal mining. And Craig Aaron, managing director of the media reform group Free Press, who takes a critical look at a recent proposal from Google and Verizon that would end the free public internet as we now know it. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The failed December 2009 bombing of a Detroit-bound airliner with a suicide bomber is thought to have trained in Yemen has put that nation long associated with terrorism back in the headlines. In response, the Obama White House has launched a massive counterattack against al-Qaeda operatives in the poor, ethnically divided Middle Eastern nation. Yemen's President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who has ruled the country for 32 years, has had a hot and cold relationship with the United States, while taking a hands-off approach to Islamic militants, including al-Qaeda. A big American push in Yemen with millions of dollars in new military aid would help Saleh, who faces two locally based insurgencies and a 40% unemployment rate. Saleh's hands-off policy towards al-Qaeda is best understood in light of the influx of Islamic fighters fleeing to Yemen after the Soviet Union left Afghanistan and the exodus of Yemeni workers from Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of the first Gulf War in the early 1990s. Many of the Islamic fighters were recruited into Yemen's military or in the paramilitary groups loyal to Saleh used to fight insurgencies. In 2000, the American Navy ship USS Cole was attacked by al-Qaeda in the Yemeni port of Aden. Saleh then prevented U.S. investigators from probing deeply into militant networks. But all that changed after September 11, 2001, when Yemen's president became an ally of the American War on Terror and invited U.S. special forces to train Yemen's military and launched attacks against al-Qaeda inside Yemen. Hidden behind Europe's recent debt crisis, the sinking euro, street protests, and new austerity budgets is over a decade of supply-side tax cuts that has fueled new levels of economic inequality. Since the mid-1990s, Germany has cut its corporate tax rate by 27%, along with sharp tax cuts for wealthy individuals. According to The Nation magazine, France and Spain joined the tax-cutting club by slashing the top tax rate by 13%. Like the United States, Europe has reduced its reliance on personal and corporate income taxes, favoring instead regressive sales and value-added taxes. The legacy of supply-side tax cuts has hurt Europe's ability to respond to the current recession. Peter Bofinger of the German Council of Economic Experts noted, "If we had the tax rates we had in 1998, we would have 75 billion more euros in revenue each year." He noted that countries that refrain from major tax cuts, such as those in Scandinavia, are in a better fiscal position. Ironically, the major tax cuts were initiated by center-left political parties like the Socialists in France and Social Democrats in Germany. They followed the economic orthodoxy championed in the United States, which dictates that economic growth comes from lower taxes on capital. And when center-right parties came into power in recent years, they cut taxes even further. The sale of raw or unpasteurized milk has become a major battleground between public health officials and organic consumers and sustainable dairy farmers. In Massachusetts, the Department of Agricultural Resources proposed regulations that would ban the off-the-farm sale and distribution of raw milk. The state government has issued a number of cease and desist orders against buying clubs that purchase raw milk directly from small dairy farmers. The Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control, along with other health groups, oppose consumption of raw milk. According to the news magazine In These Times, health agencies see a risk in raw milk generating a small number of cases of foodborne illnesses. Organic advocates counter that by asserting that any danger comes from the way big dairies do business. To protect farmers, the pro-raw milk group, The Right to Choose Healthy Food, is working to establish private co-ops of farmers to circumvent current health regulations on dairy products. Mark McAfee, owner of Organic Pastures, the largest raw milk dairy in California, boasts that food inspectors have never found any pathogen in his dairy products. McAfee claims raw milk contains natural enzymes that kill pathogens, enzymes that he says are killed during the pasteurization process. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
In testimony before Congress in February, President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, declared that the President reserves the right to have the CIA carry out assassinations against U.S. citizens who are engaged in terrorist activity. His comments before the House Intelligence Committee were directed at Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen who is thought to be living in Yemen. Al-Awlaki, who was born in Las Cruces, New Mexico, is accused of being a leader in Al-Qaeda, whose sermons were attended by three of the 9/11 hijackers. Fort Hood shooter Nidal Malik Hassan and the failed Christmas Day bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab both say they met with and were inspired and or trained by Al-Awlaki. During the first week of August, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control to obtain a license which is required under federal regulations to represent anyone named as a specially designated global terrorist, which al-Awlaki was about 2 weeks after his father, Nasser, retained the ACLU and Center for Constitutional Rights to represent him in an effort to stop the government's targeted killing. The Treasury Department responded to the suit by granting the license on August 4th, clearing the way for the two groups to seek a federal court injunction preventing the Obama administration from assassinating al-Awlaki without due process of law. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Maines, a legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. He explains the important precedents being established in the court challenge to the Obama administration's self-declared authority to assassinate U.S. citizens outside war zones without charge, trial, or any constitutional checks and balances.
This is another example of a situation where it appears that President Obama is entrenching and in some cases actually extending the sort of framework that was established by President Bush. So, you know, during the Bush administration, there was lots of concern, lots of outcry from many quarters about the Bush administration's claimed authority to detain people who were picked up anywhere in the world, including inside the United States, and put them in prison with charge or trial indefinitely. There's also concern about, you know, picking people up anywhere in the world and charging them and trying them in military commissions. These are all powers that are restricted to battlefield situations, circumstances where there's an actual war going on. Now, what President Obama has done is he's sort of run with this idea of the global battlefield. The idea there being that rules that are intended to govern the conduct of a war can apply anywhere in the world that the government believes a suspect might be found. So it appears, we don't know, because the government hasn't actually set out its legal theory and still hasn't set out the criteria that it uses in deciding whether a U.S. citizen can be targeted for death. But it appears that they're taking the view that they can use quintessentially warlike means and warlike rules anywhere in the world, including in places like Yemen, where the United States isn't at war. So it's hard to say why they've decided to proceed as they have with so little transparency and with, you know, as far as we can tell, no due process.
Jonathan, there are many people in this country believing the country should do everything possible to prevent future attacks who are probably fully on board this idea of killing al-Awlaki in Yemen. How do you counter the idea that the Obama administration should afford any U.S. citizen, regardless of the charge or where they're living, with due process and forego this course they're on to assassinate this guy out in Yemen?
Well, you know, I think that, unfortunately, in the last several years, it's become very sort of commonplace for people to think that the only way for us to be safe is to sacrifice bedrock civil liberties and constitutional rights that have served us well for generations. Now, we think that there's no contradiction. It's entirely possible to have a robust counterterrorism effort while still remaining within limits that are set out by our Constitution and other sources of law. So what I would say to those that think there's no problem here, I just point out how remarkable the assertive power that the president is claiming is. I mean, what we're talking about here is the power to put U.S. citizens on a list, which then authorizes the military and the CIA to hunt them and kill them anywhere in the world, even thousands of miles from any war zone or battlefield. And it's doing so without revealing to anybody outside of probably a small group of people in administration what criteria have to be met before a person, before a U.S. citizen can be hunted and killed, without any sense of what the process is that's in place within the administration, and certainly without any checks outside of the administration. So the idea that the president has a unilateral authority to set up the standards that will govern when a citizen can die, and then has the authority to, you know, be prosecutor, judge, and jury, and I suppose executioner in applying those standards, is quite remarkable. And I think that at the level of principle, most people can agree that that's not a power that we want to entrust to the unchecked executive branch. If we endorse this as a precedent, other countries may well think that, you know, they have license to kill their suspect enemies anywhere in the world.
Jonathan Maines, your lawsuit may very well end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Your challenge to the executive authority, the president, to assassinate a U.S. citizen without due process. What do we know about the Supreme Court's past decisions in this? We know that in the Yasser Hamdi case, by a lopsided majority, the Supreme Court actually denied that the executive branch has unchecked authority to designate somebody an enemy combatant and keep them in prison forever without charge or trial. Do you think the same opinion may hold sway in today's Supreme Court if this case came to them?
I hope so, and I think you're right. I think the Supreme Court has, on four key occasions, they've heard cases involving the president's asserted authority in the post-9/11 era, and they have come out the right way. You know, in that Hamdi opinion reference, then-Justice O'Connor said that the authorization for use of force after 9/11 was not a blank check to the president. I think it would be difficult for a court confronted with this issue to ignore it or to simply endorse unreviewed the president's asserted authority to set the standards by which citizens will be killed and then to go out and do that anywhere in the world. So we're talking about the most fundamental right, the right to life. And the Constitution is pretty clear that no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. So we're hoping that by bringing this issue to the courts, the program and the asserted authority will be reviewed where it should be in a judicial forum.
That was Jonathan Maines, a legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. For more information on the lawsuit, call the ACLU at area code 202-457-0800 or visit the websites aclu.org or ccrjustice.org. A longtime West Virginia politician and progressive activist is running in the Democratic primary August 28th against incumbent Governor Joe Manchin to be the party's candidate in the November 2nd special election to replace the late U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd. Ken Heckler, who will be 96 in September, was born in New York, earned a Ph.D. in history and government from Columbia University, and held several jobs before moving to West Virginia in 1957. The following year, he won his first election to Congress and served in the House from 1959 to 1977. After leaving his House seat, he served as West Virginia's Secretary of State from 1985 to 2001. The former legislator has been a longtime foe of surface coal mining, introducing legislation to abolish it in the early 1960s. He was also principal sponsor of the 1969 Coal Mine Health and Safety Act. In 2000, he walked more than 500 miles with the late Doris Granady Haddock on her cross-country walk to promote campaign finance reform, something he believed was urgently needed due to the disproportionate contributions of coal company officials to West Virginia politicians. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus caught up with Heckler by phone as he traveled around his state calling for an end to mountaintop removal mining and seeking votes in the upcoming election.
I've always been opposed to surface mining. I think you should characterize mountaintop removal as strip mining on steroids because it's far more devastating, particularly to the people in the valleys. And I think the only solution is abolition rather than regulation. The reason regulation will not work is because the coal industry has deep pockets and can contribute millions of dollars to every member of the legislature, as well as the governor and members of the judicial branch, the Supreme Court of West Virginia.
And, of course, historically and up to the present day, coal interests have contributed to members of the congressional delegation from West Virginia, both Republicans and Democrats, and to many other states, though never to you. Now, Ken Heckler, you have a long history of working on mining issues, going back to your early years in Congress in the 1960s. Tell us about some of those efforts.
Early on in my congressional career, I introduced a bill to abolish strip mining within 18 months, and I had over 100 sponsors of that bill in the House of Representatives. The problem with my abolition bill was that in the 1970s, when OPEC began to regulate and limit the amount of oil coming into this country, there was a so-called energy crisis in the United States, which caused many members of Congress to oppose my efforts to abolish strip mining. So I lost support because of the fear that many members had that we would run out of support for energy. I think today that the need to abolish mountaintop removal is even more urgent because of the fact that it is possible to mine coal through underground mining, which used to be very dangerous, but since I was able to enact the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, there's been a dramatic reduction in fatalities. April 5th, 29 miners were killed at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. All 29 miners would be alive today if my 1969 Act had been enforced, because there's a provision that I wrote into the 1969 Act that obligates every coal mine to have a stream of fresh air no less than 9,000 cubic feet per minute. Yet that stipulation was totally ignored by the owners of the Upper Big Branch mine, thereby resulting in the explosion of methane and other explosive gases.
When Senator Robert Byrd died in office earlier this year, Governor Joe Manchin appointed a placeholder and announced that he would run for the seat in the special election later this year. And when you announced that you were running against him, you said you weren't running to win, but just to raise the issue of mountaintop removal mining. Are you actively campaigning?
Yes. For example, yesterday I was down at the Mercer County Fair in Bluefield, West Virginia, which is the southernmost county of West Virginia. I got a tremendously positive reaction from everybody I talked with. After I finish this interview this evening, I'm going over to what is known as the Mesa Fest, which is a black-supported community celebration with lots of music. And last night I was there until 10:30 p.m. and got a tremendously positive reaction. In fact, I'm getting a overwhelmingly positive reaction from everybody I run into, and I'm not just sitting in my office trying to make phone calls. I'm going out all around the 55 counties of the state, and my schedule is pretty well packed between now and the 28th of August when the primary election occurs.
What if you win?
Well, I must say that even though I started not expecting to win, now I'm emphasizing the fact that I will fight to win.
So you may be going back to Congress.
Even though I'm 3 years older than Senator Byrd, nevertheless, I think you can tell that although I may have a body of 95 years old, I have the mind, the heart, the passion, and the vigor of a 35-year-old.
That was Ken Heckler, who's running in the Democratic primary August 28th to be the party's candidate in the November 2nd special election to replace the late U.S. Senator Robert C. Byrd. For more information on the campaign, visit his website, kenhecklerforwestvirginia.org. After years of debate between giant telecommunication companies and public advocates on the need to protect free public access to the Internet, qualities which make this communications platform such a hothouse for innovation and vibrant democratic discourse, the issue seems to be coming to a head. While the Federal Communications Commission dithered in taking steps to safeguard an open Internet, often referred to as net neutrality, Google and Verizon were in negotiations to develop their own vision of how the Internet will function in the future. In an August 9th announcement, Google and Verizon put forward a joint policy proposal that envisions two Internets, one public and one private. The private Internet would provide a fast lane to content for those who could afford it, with lots of bells and whistles if you pay to play. The Google-Verizon proposal would eliminate the concept of net neutrality on wireless networks, the destination most observers believe the Internet as a whole is rapidly moving toward, and at the same time weaken the FCC's ability to effectively regulate the Internet. The media reform group, Free Press, has for years been actively engaged in the fight for net neutrality, and along with other national organizations that are part of the Save the Internet Coalition, is urging President Obama, Congress, and the FCC to reject the Google-Verizon proposal and instead pass strong net neutrality protections. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Craig Aaron, Managing Director of Free Press, who examines the Google-Verizon proposal while describing the campaign now underway to defend the free and open Internet.
What's so harrowing about this proposal that Google and Verizon have put together is that it really would transform and really end the open Internet as we know it. You know, they paid lip service to the notion of an open Internet, promising, you know, that they wouldn't mess with the Internet that we have now. But what they're proposing would really transform the Internet experience for a lot of people. So basically what they've done is put out this policy framework, essentially, you know, a document that they're trying to sell Congress and to a certain degree the FCC on as, you know, here's these two big companies have gotten together, one, Google, that has historically supported net neutrality, one, Verizon, that has been one of the strongest opponents of net neutrality. And they're passing it off as a compromise, but it's really a raw deal for consumers for a couple of reasons. One is they're proposing no protections for the Internet when it's accessed on wireless networks. So it'd be as if you want to use your phone, and increasingly, of course, so many of us are going to be getting to the Internet that way, forget it. They can block, discriminate, mess with the content however they see fit under this proposal. Another thing they would do is about this sort of private Internet. They keep saying, oh, we're going to support the public Internet. We're really for that. But they're opening the door essentially to push all the investment into a new fast lane. So if you sort of imagine the information superhighway, they're looking to build out their own private toll road where big companies like Verizon and Google and Comcast and all the rest, you know, would be able to ply their wares and push their content and develop their new applications. But when it comes to everybody else, you know, we get stuck back on the winding dirt road. It would be like if I told you, Scott, that, you know, hey, great, put whatever you want up on your website, but people can only get to it with dial-up speeds. So, you know, sorry if they can't stream the program, sorry if they can't listen, but you only get dial-up. I'm going to be operating in broadband. That's basically what Google and Verizon are proposing to the rest of us. Like, hey, we're going to be over here on the private Internet doing our thing, and whatever you guys have now, well, hope that's good enough. You know, this is really not a good deal for consumers. You know, moreover, they've proposed essentially that the FCC should have no authority to make rules, that basically they could, you know, sort of answer consumer complaints, but wouldn't be in a position to set the rules of the road for everyone, which is supposed to be the FCC's job. So I think this Google-Verizon pact is really dangerous, the upside being maybe it's waking people up to the fact that net neutrality is still in danger, and despite the promises of the Obama administration and the chairman of the FCC, they still haven't delivered in terms of protecting the free and open Internet.
Craig, discuss for us, if you would, the role of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. There was a recent court decision which, in the eyes of many, handicapped the FCC's ability to regulate broadband Internet services. But there has been at least some statements by the FCC chair, Julius Genachowski, that he would like to regulate broadband Internet and maintain net neutrality through rules, regulations, and fines.
Yes, as you note, he said some great things. It's the actions that have been the problem for the current FCC chairman. I mean, he got into office, He'd been a key member of the Obama campaign. Net neutrality was the top item on their technology agenda. He gave a very powerful speech almost a year ago at the Brookings Institution, laying out his vision for the open Internet. An excellent speech, a great vision. It sounded like he was going to do all the right things, and he hasn't delivered on them. And you're also right that the federal court case has really complicated things. But that throws it actually back to the FCC, which has in their power, Julius Genachowski has in his power, the ability to say, you know what, we are going to reclassify broadband. We're going to regulate it the way we always did before the Bush years, and that's going to allow us to protect Internet users. They started down that road. They got a lot of pushback from the powerful phone and cable lobby. They started to waver. Then they were pushed back by the public interest community and came up with what was called a third way, which was essentially a very narrow, what's called reclassification, but then they haven't delivered on that. And so instead of moving forward with these rules, what they did is they started trying to have side closed-door negotiations with the biggest phone and cable companies and the biggest content companies like Google. Those negotiations have now been called off partly because of this Verizon-Google deal. But I think if the FCC had really stepped into the void much earlier, been much clearer about what they were going to do, we wouldn't really be in the mess we're in now, although the irony being that that mess may actually push the FCC to take action again. So it's a strange moment, and it's complicated even further by Congress, where AT&T, Comcast, these big companies spend, you know, more on lobbying and campaign contributions than any industry except for the drug industry. They're a huge presence on Capitol Hill, and they've been able to convince dozens and dozens of members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to write to the FCC and say, don't do this reclassification thing. Ultimately, it's a free speech issue. And it's about whether this amazing technology that, you know, was originally developed by our government and has created so much opportunity, whether that's still going to be there or whether we're, again, just going to give it away to a small group of companies that are looking out only for their bottom line.
That was Craig Aaron, Managing Director of Free Press. Contact Free Press toll-free at 877-888-1533 or visit their SaveTheInternet.com website. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.